We're doomed, we're saved.
The BioRevolution Podcast.
Your hosts, Luise von Stechow
and Andreas Horchler. We are doomed, we're saved. Today, AI and drug development expanding the option space. Hello, Easy, how are you?
Good morning, I'm excellent. It's sunny weather in Berlin today.
Yeah, Frankfurt too, so summer is not over yet, not quite. Easy, I see the profound impact AI has on pharma, medicine, biology, by the sheer number of publications, startups popping up, the overall fascination and scare AI plants into the minds of people in all walks of life. All this is topic today in We're Doomed, We're Saved. As always, you brought quotes.
Yeah. So one of the quotes that I brought, I think, is related to medicine, but applies very well also to the process of drug development. And it's from Siddhartha Mukherjee. He's an oncologist and also an entrepreneur, but I think he's best known for his work as a writer for books like The Emperor of All Maladies, The Gene, or The Song of the Cell. And he said in a recent interview about the potential of AI in medicine, I think people are using the word AI too loosely in medicine. We need to be accurate about the use cases and also determine the difference between productivity and creativity. And I think this space between productivity and creativity is something that applies very well also to the process of drug development and to the potential that artificial intelligence has there. I also brought another quote by a venture capitalist. Venture capital at the moment is, I think, at least in some aspects, not too hyped on AI. And I think this is a nice one because it puts the question of AI-discovered drugs a little bit into perspective, and we'll dive into that in a bit. So it's from Patrick Malone, who's a principal at KDT Ventures, and he says of AI, if you take the hype and PR at face value over the last 10 years, you would think that it goes from 5 to 90%. But if you know how these models work, it goes from 5 maybe to 6 or 7%. And this is about the probability of success that a drug will actually make it from the entry into the clinic to the market, which currently is estimated to be somewhere between 5 and 10%. And I think this really sums up nicely these inflated hopes that people have in the technology that, of course, can only lead to disappointment.
Yeah, of course. And there's a warning, I think, that we really see, and we'll dive into that as well. I mean, both aspects, productivity and creativity, we'll talk about that. And of course, the venture capitalists are necessary for further development, and they have to trust the technology that it really works. Let's start, Easy, by determining the lay of the land, kind of. So where do we stand and where do we come from?
This already is a question to summarize several podcasts.
Okay, 2 hours later.
Yeah, 2 hours. Okay. So on the one hand, we come from the side of drug development, which is an extremely expensive process. Estimates are around 2 billion, sometimes even a bit higher, sometimes also a bit lower. So it depends, of course, on the type of drug that's being developed. But one can say in summary, it's a very expensive process. And as I said in the introduction, it's also very prone to fail. So only 10% about of the drugs that enter into the clinic make it to the market. That already, like even from a very, let's say, simplistic mathematical perspective, doesn't seem like a really worthwhile business model. So drugs really need to, let's put it like that, pharma has only so many shots on goal to bring good drugs to the market, because it's so expensive to fail. The later it gets in development, the more expensive it gets to fail. So in order to bring innovation, to bring new molecules, new targets to patients, pharma really needs to be certain that it's a good molecule, a good hypothesis that they bring into a clinical trial in order not to waste a lot of money. And this wasting money is harmful, not only, of course, for the business of pharma, it's also harmful for the patients because they would not get a treatment. And also the drugs, of course, become more expensive due to the fact that they cost more in development. So in summary, somehow, on the one hand, and this is the efficiency aspect, getting drugs through the development faster and at lower costs is, of course, very beneficial. But on the other hand, we also have the idea of creating better drugs that have a higher probability of success, so that will less likely fail. And I think this is also really important. Yeah, so that was the side of drug development, the lay of the land. And then we come from the other side, which is artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence, one has to say, means a lot of things to a lot of different people. So it's really not one terminology. It's a lot of different things. But what in the current years we understand with artificial intelligence is mostly deep learning technology. So deep neural networks that learn on a large amount of data and then form a picture of the world. And one very exciting example of that was the success of the program AlphaGo that was developed by DeepMind. DeepMind is a spin-off of Google. And they developed a Go computer. And this not only beat the human champion Lee Sedol in 2016, but it made a move, the infamous move 37, that no human had ever made before in the history of the game Go. And Go seems to be, on the one hand, much more complex than chess. I cannot even play chess, so I cannot testify to that, but strategically highly, highly competitive game. And it's over 2,000 years old, the game. So it seems that in the recorded history, no human ever thought of this move. And for some, this is seen as a sign of machine creativity. To be debated. I mean, this is always the anthropomorphizing that we're doing with the machines. But this is one of these moments where it's like, oh, AI can do that. And this is what Max Tegmark, he's a Swedish science philosopher and physicist, he calls them AI holy shit moments in his book Life 3.0. There are a couple more. But this for sure is one of them. And I think this is translatable, of course, to other areas that we have not only the gain of efficiency of looking through data faster, but also this potential of increasing creativity, which of course would be super exciting.
So you named all the threats in drug development, as well as the so-called holy shit moments that seem to signal a breakthrough. At which points in this process, 2 billion per new drug, you need 5 to 10 years, you need real people to test those new drugs. Where has AI the capability to come to the rescue at this point while we're talking? This picture might be very different in 2 months or in a year or so, but right now.
So right now, the main application for AI is in the early stages of the development process. So the discovery of new targets and the discovery and design of new molecules, either chemical molecules or biological molecules, for example, antibodies and other biologic drugs. So here already we see quite a lot of progress with targets and molecules that have been discovered, and I'm doing air quotes now, which the listeners cannot see, have been discovered by artificial intelligence. And they are entering clinical trials and they're progressing in clinical trials and they're getting first readouts that look positive. And the question is, what does that mean at the current stage? So I think there's a lot to unpack around this story of AI discovered drugs. On the one hand, you have a number of companies, I call them AI first biotechs. It's like smaller companies or growing, now some of them are quite large actually, companies that don't center, so usually biotech companies would center around either a disease hypothesis. So for example, we're coming from a university studying Alzheimer, we have a good idea and we spin out a company based on that. Or, for example, around a specific modality. For example, we are really good at designing new antibodies and that's our game. But these AI first companies, they're really focused on AI at their core. That's their claim to fame, basically. And they have been pushing for some years now a narrative that makes you believe that AI is basically the hammer for any nail. AI will fix everything, and claim this AI-based drug discovery and development. And here, of course, the question is how much does AI contribute to that and how much faster will it get? And I think here we're already seeing real successes in the sense that the discovery and preclinical testing of the molecules gets a lot faster. For example, the first molecule to ever, or first AI discovered, again, I'm air quoting, which no one can see, molecule that entered clinical development from the company Exscientia, they did the preclinical stages, I think, in about a year. which is a significant gain in efficiency. And the similar efficiency gains in the design of small molecules were, for example, claimed by InSilico for their TNIK inhibitor or TNIK inhibitor for IPF, and also for more recently discovered antibodies. And this, of course, already just saving the time of, I don't know, even saving 10% of time in this extremely expensive process means a lot. Saving 50% of the time means a lot more. Of course, the early stages are a lot less expensive, but you still have a quicker pipeline of shooting drugs basically into the pipeline. So you get more shots on goal. It's like you're competing in dart, but you have 6 more shots than anyone else. So you still have a higher chance, of course, to become the winner, because you just have more shots on goal. So I think this is one part of it. And I think here we're really seeing the first successes. The other question is really, are these molecules better or are these targets better? And I think this is really there. The verdict for me is still out, because most of those newly discovered drugs, so the ones that are AI discovered, most of them are actually against well-known targets. So the question is really what the novelty aspect is in that sense. Not really there. It's not for all of them, but many of them are just against well-established targets in this disease context. So, of course, even without AI, you could say, great, I know this target works. Let's design a new molecule against that. Right. So the success and failure of these, and I think it actually, in my opinion, makes complete sense to use well-established targets here also. The problem in pharma is you can only include so much novelty. So having everything new is usually very bad idea. So having a new type of molecule and a new target and a new hypothesis is not a good mixture, because then if you fail, you really don't know why. So doing new stuff where you have one very well established component is actually a quite smart idea in order to gauge your long-term success. So I think in that sense, this is not stupid. The only question is, what does it mean to assess the benefit of AI in the process? So is AI really making these drugs better? I think at the current stage is a little bit hard to judge, but also it doesn't really matter so much, because I mean, we're seeing that we can use AI to accelerate some of the processes, and we're seeing that we can use it for increasing the option space of knowing targets, of new chemical matter, new biological matter. So in that sense, I think maybe, and this is of course a very hard thing to do in an industry that depends very much on venture capital, where you need to put out headlines, and also in the business of the people who make the headlines, where you need to have like something catchy, like New York Times recent headline saying AI is revolutionizing drug development. And you see that, of course, many times. And if something is revolutionizing and shifting the paradigm and all these other great phrases, I mean, it's amazing, of course. I mean, people will read what you wrote and will listen to you. But maybe it's also fine to just relax a little bit and wait till we have a bigger N. Because currently, I think we have around, or that's an analysis, I think, from 2-3 months ago, maybe around 10 AI discovered drugs in phase 2. So in the second clinical testing phase, where we will start seeing results in a bigger number of patients, where we will know how well does it really work and is it worth it to pursue further. And I think just waiting a little bit to see more of that will tell us more about how much better maybe AI discovered molecules and targets can be.
It speaks volumes, the venture capitalists saying, okay, we have the PR promising, like we make a jump from 5% to 90%, and the reality is 6 to 7%. And then the appetite to invest is shrinking. Obviously, people will be disappointed, and that increases the threat of another AI winter that has been there in the past already, right?
Yeah. I mean, I have to say that I think most of the biotechs, they don't claim that they will get to 90%. I think actually not at all over the whole process. But I think it's this perception, because you always have these, I mean, it's what ends up with a reader. And I mean, the deeper you dig, once you're one of these AI skeptics, really picks everything apart and looks at every single target and then knows, yeah, but this was not discovered with AI, then of course you get to the other side of the picture. But I think for the general interest level, I think this perception of very high success rates, and there was also a recent publication by BCG Group that also had this conclusion that there is 80 to 90% success rates, I think, of AI discovered drugs, again, in phase one. But then the question again arises, how much was the contribution of AI to some of those drugs? Because I think that is a key challenge within this field. And again, something that we cannot solve from the outside, and maybe also we don't have to solve it, but it's very difficult to look under the hood of these companies. So of course you can write on your website, I'm using AI end to end. Everything I'm doing is done with AI. And I think for some of the companies like InSilico, that seems also to be quite true. But for other companies, it's really just the question, how much does AI contribute to that? I mean, because I could also say I am doing my work with ChatGPT. I am doing an AI-enabled piece of work because ChatGPT writes the text for it. That's, mm-hmm. I mean, that's true, right? But it doesn't really mean that the drug was discovered by ChatGPT.
Absolutely not. And for instance, I mean, you know, there are fields within the realm of AI that are definitely less sexy than really finding molecules. I'm talking about, for instance, all the regulatory stuff that comes with drug development. And that's an obvious use case, I would say, that is, again, less spectacular, maybe, but applicable, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's actually, I mean, as you say, it might not appear as sexy on first glance, but I think it's also a real hard use case where AI could make a great contribution in, I mean, these regulatory filing documents can be, I don't know, thousands of pages long. And next to having these regulatory documents, once you approach having a drug entering the market, again, also have to negotiate with a payer. So you also need to have the same story for reimbursement. Not only do you need to get your drug approved, you also need to convince someone like a payer that it's actually worth it to put it on your list of drugs that you support. So, and this is really nitty gritty paperwork, and I think their large language models hopefully will soon make a large contribution in streamlining that and making that better. I think we're still at the stage where we have a little bit, and we talked about that extensively in our recent ChatGPT or LLM episode, this hallucination problem.
Right.
So in these documents, you really cannot make a mistake because it might mean that your drug is not getting approved based on a hallucination of the model. That would be very, I mean, then you're also losing a lot of money with that. So
absolutely. On the other hand, I would always say that it's a less time consuming task to proofread in opposition to actually writing the thing, you know?
That is actually to be determined, I think, because I think proofreading can also, so I think here we really need to understand the trade-off between how much manual or human work needs to go into that. But I think still, I mean, even if this could be a labor-intensive double-checking, I think in the future and these where, I mean, seeing, first of all, I think the new models, again, have some improvements. I think Strawberry is not yet out, but coming out soon. And from what I am seeing in my LinkedIn feed, there are increasing bar charts where it performs much better. Mainly reasoning, not so much the hallucination thing. I haven't seen it yet. But I think having some kind of sensing tool that recognizes when these models hallucinate will really help us there. And I think, I mean, this is not only true for text generation, these transformer-based models, or what we would see as a large language model, as layman, let's put it like that. They are increasingly also used for molecular or for molecule design and molecule analysis, both for small molecules, but also now increasingly for biologics and for understanding DNA sequences. And I think this is vast potential here for these models. And of course, also there are other deep learning models involved, but just having new molecules designed that we couldn't think of and then screen them very fast. This really increases the option space. And I think that this is, again, bringing us back to this question of efficiency against creativity. And I think there is a use case for both in that, because we have on the one hand the efficiency gain of just being able to scan new things very quickly. There are, I mean, many, many headlines in antibody design. Also, for example, NVIDIA, a quantum company, is collaborating with many pharma companies, but also with biotechs like Recursion, scanning new molecules super fast and then just saving a lot of time. And that, again, is the one story. You can scan potentially molecules or design molecules, simulate molecules so much faster. But on the other end of the spectrum, you can also just expand the space of possible molecules. You can have, so for the chemical space, the idea is currently that, I'm not a chemist, so I'm just quoting some figures that I got from articles, that we're currently seeing, so the libraries of, or the screening libraries of big pharma combined, are around 10 million small molecules, chemical molecules, but that the option space is somewhere in the range of 10 to the power of 30 or 10 to the power of 60. So there's a universe of molecules we haven't seen. And of course, some of them might work very well on targets. And I think one really interesting aspect that is not talked about so much, but I think that could become very relevant, is the question that with new types of molecules, you might be able to address new kinds of targets. Currently, we have only a limited pool of druggable proteins in our cells. So we need to have some properties of these intracellular proteins that play a role in disease to make them addressable by small molecules. You need to somehow have like a binding pocket within the protein that can be addressed. And this limits significantly the amount of proteins that can be targeted, but that also leaves around 70% or 80% of the proteins that cannot be targeted, that include many, many, many disease-relevant proteins. So you would just expand the potential to really target new avenues for targeting your disease. And this is really fascinating. And we're seeing that with new classes of molecules, for example, PROTACs, which inhibit the stability of proteins. And there might be millions of other of those things around that we can exploit. And that would really, I mean, not only expand the option space, but introduce a complete new level of creativity. And we're seeing so many new exciting modalities at the moment. I mean, it used to be for such a long time that we only had small molecules. And now, I mean, mRNAs are really expanding, gene therapies are expanding, new types of small molecules are expanding, antibodies are becoming more specific. We have a huge class of antibody drug conjugates that have a very potent action. So I'm talking very fast because it's very exciting and there is a lot going on, and AI can just help matching all these possibilities, all these new targets we haven't explored, all these new modalities. And on top of that, also help us to find the right patient for each of those, because the patients often, I mean, currently most evidence-based medicine just has like this one-size-fits-all approach. And there are now emerging, of course, more personalized therapies, but it could be that in the future, again, aided by artificial intelligence, you might have a much more specific selection of patient factors, genetic makeup, other biomarkers, but also just factors like your age or even where you're located, that would match you very specifically to a new therapy. And of course, the more targeted, the more personalized the therapy is, the easier it would also be to work. That said, I think all of that would really challenge or change the current business model of pharma. And I think what we're seeing at the moment, we discussed that in a couple of episodes, is on the one side, of course, this trend towards personalization, which is great. But I think on the other side, also a little bit by the market decline that was after the pandemic, I mean, there was a huge drop, that we're looking again a little bit more into this like blockbuster disease areas like metabolic disease, autoimmune disease, obesity, GLP-1 inhibitors like Ozempic. So really, again, looking for something that you can sell to a lot of people.
Izzy, let's seal the episode with an outlook, of course. I mean, we named some of the threats and the huge potential coming with AI. You just told us the story about the amazing outlook we're facing and the probabilities and the possibilities coming with AI. Then on the other hand, we have the venture capitalists who are on hold a little bit right now because more has been promised than given, for now at least. And then, of course, we have the doomsday evangelists like Elon Musk, who says, well, be careful, it's going to do what it's going to do, and we won't have a clue what it's doing, the AI. So to have this whole picture along with the regulatory differences between, for instance, the European Union and the US, and other factors, of course, the willingness of civil societies to adapt AI within itself, all those factors will kind of define the future of AI and drug development to some extent. So what is your conclusion for now?
You brought up a lot of questions. So let's fast forward 2 hours later after I answered all of
once
that.
More.
Once
yeah.
again,
okay.
We do that at the beginning and at the end of this episode. No, I think it's really difficult to predict the future of AI in the sense that the contribution of these models is just changing so fast. And I mean, I don't think that we've reached the end. So at the moment, we have this deep learning based, mainly convolutional networks, and at the moment, transformer based networks that are very efficient at doing certain tasks, but they're also not so good at doing other tasks. So it might be that I'm pretty sure that a lot of the AI companies are working on newer models that I at least have never heard about, but that, I mean, might have the similar effect as ChatGPT in 3 years. So that is one thing. And I think already, I mean, for these large language models, I think one of the developers I listened to, like an audio book where they discussed the potential of ChatGPT in medicine, and they said that it randomized the future. And it's a little bit true. I think, I mean, there was a big hype around ChatGPT, and it's not all that it's said to be. But one also has to say, in daily life, it's the first time, I think, that everyone really feels the contribution of AI. I think it's one of the fastest adapted user technologies that's out there. And this is something that is felt. So before, AI used to be something that maybe you talk about, or you, as you say, listen to Elon Musk saying it will lead to humanity's downfall, and other people saying it will lead to job loss and radiologists will be obsolete and we will only have self-driving cars, etc. But I think ChatGPT is the first example where really most people or many people are using it and exploring also the interaction with an AI. And I think this is part of the future, I mean, irrespective now of drug development, that the interaction between the human and the computer will get a lot stronger, especially if anything that's integrated into the smartphones and potentially maybe in the next generations, also in neuroprosthetics, will just link us much closer to AI. If it comes to the potential of AI and drug development, I think currently we're really more at the stage of seeing these time-saving, efficiency-saving aspects being realized. And I think that's perfectly fine. And this is very valid and very meaningful. And I think it's sometimes underestimated that this is also very meaningful to have that. And I think that the other aspects, the creativity-inducing ones, are just a little bit more slow-burning. I think it's maybe also comparable with the effects of the Human Genome Project. For example, when we had AlphaFold, so we didn't discuss that, but this is a protein prediction AI, which also was a huge hype and was considered, I mean, it was in many headlines touted as the biggest contribution that AI has ever made to humanity, was said it will change everything in Nature magazine. So this was really like perceived as a big change. It contributes a lot of protein structures. It makes quite a few mistakes in those as well, because it also hallucinates. It's only as good as the input data. Again, this is something that is true for all deep neural networks. Garbage in, garbage out. If you don't have proprietary good data, what comes out will not be as good. So here it's really the question, if you look back, so how much has AlphaFold contributed? Do we have 1,000 antibody drugs now, 2 years later? No, we don't.
We don't.
But do we have to? No, we don't. I think having this compendium of protein structures and a tool that we can integrate into other protein prediction analysis, which is something that many biotechs are doing and academic groups, is super meaningful and similar to the Human Genome Project. I mean, we had this quote from Clinton in, I think, a couple of episodes where it is like the most important map that humanity has ever created, and cancer will soon be a thing of the past. I'm like quoting like loosely here because I don't remember exactly. But I mean, this didn't happen immediately, and it hasn't happened more than 20 years later, but that doesn't mean that the Human Genome Project and the decoding of the human genome didn't contribute massively to the development of new drugs.
Yes,
and I
of
think
course.
The same is true for AI, the same is true for the contribution of AlphaFold, of large language models that build and design new molecules that lead to genetic understanding. All of that will create a huge compendium of knowledge that allows us to be more creative. Because before, I mean, if we don't know the basis, how can we be creative? For me, creativity is the shuffling of information in unexpected ways. I would call it like that. When I'm writing, I would say like having this eureka moments is when you make a connection between two things and you feel like, yeah, this is it. This is what I've been looking for. And I think the same would be true for drug development. And having more knowledge and having a tool that allows you to scan through this knowledge more quickly is, I think, what will really benefit drug development on the long run. But it will probably take a couple more years.
So we're betting on AI, but we stay realistic. Thank you, Izzy.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you all for listening. This was We're Doomed, We're Saved for today, and I really guess it's by far not the last time we spoke about AI. We're very interested to hear what you say about our podcast. Please write us at sciencetales.com. Please subscribe to the show and tell us about your biorevolution topics that you would like us to cover. Thank you.